Danny, Danny Schechter,
known as the News Dissector.
You know, I joined media, preserving democracy, do something about the problems of the world. I'm the author, I'm the producer.
Hey, hello everybody, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
Issues, the history of the world.
Hey, hello, I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector.
That's me, that's what I think. That's what I think. Demands for justice, losing their hope. Working class solidarity, co-opted. The media. Issues. That's me. That's what I think. Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. What do you think?
And what do you think? Welcome, everyone. It's a new year. We're here. We're back. Polar Levine and myself, Danny Schechter, News Dissector, on the air on the Progressive Radio Network. If you want to call in, there's a number to call, 888-874-4888. The number again, 888-874-4888. This is the first show of the new year here on PRN-FM. We're pleased to have you with us. We're going to be talking about some very interesting issues in the next half hour, beginning at 5:30. We're going to be talking with the people on the very first day of the legalization of marijuana in Colorado. And we have the head of the National... Polar, help me here.
It is the deputy director of the National Cannabis Association, Betty Aldworth.
You can't go any higher than that.
You cannot.
In fact, you can get higher, and it may be that she's getting higher as we speak. But
we
will talk with her at 5:30. We're beginning the show this week also to talk about a problem that people are not talking about, which is what's happening in the America that we don't see, the 2+ million people behind bars in this country. When we grew up, it was Russia that was supposedly the state of incredible incarceration. Now we're in the United States of incarceration. And as you would expect, there are many injustices to be discussed, and we're going to be coming back and speaking with the brother of a man who is currently in a supermax prison in Colorado, the state that has now legalized marijuana but has not legalized, apparently, social justice, at least not in its prison system. So we're going to hear from him in a minute and talk about being behind bars. How are you doing, Polar? How was your New Year's Eve?
It was very quiet, which is the way I like it these days. I'm expecting a year that is better than last year.
And joining us in the studio today as well, the big boss, the new boss, the man who is playing a crucial role in transforming the Progressive Radio Network, who you're going to hear more about and who I'm discussing the future of this network with. Harris, say hello, introduce yourself.
Danny, it is the best. It is a real honor to be here with you.
There you go.
Over the course of my life, I have followed you, I have listened to you, and to be sitting across from you in these studios is a treat.
I'm crying, I'm weeping. So stay with us here as we proceed with the News Dissector Radio Hour on PRN-FM.
Now that I'm locked up, I rep two sets, so I'm a ride or die and stay deep locked up. Two toothbrushes up, whoever wanted would pee. When I walk by, nigga, get up, cause I'm locked up. They can't get me out. I smoke a stick of haze when they stress me out. Go and hit the bar when the wrecks be out. Can't wait for the day when they let me out.
Visitation no longer comes by. Seems like they forgot about me. Commissary is getting empty. Cellmates eating food without me. Can't wait to get out and move forward with my life. Got a family that loves me and wants me to do right. But instead I'm here locked up. They won't let me out.
Yeah, we're listening to Akon and Styles P, a song called Locked Up. And we're going to be talking about being locked up.
And with us on the phone, Faisal Hashmi. I hope I have that name right. The brother of Fahad Hashmi, who's currently in a supermax prison in Colorado. The Center for Center for Constitutional Rights is bringing a new case on conditions of confinement. And this is a particularly urgent issue for the people who are confined, and it should be a particularly urgent issue for the people who are not confined, but who believe somewhere deep in their soul that there is something called human rights and it applies to all people. Faisal is the co-founder of the Muslim Justice Initiative. He's a virtual encyclopedia of information on many, many federal cases. And we're really happy to have you with us, brother, to talk about your brother. What is his status right now?
So my brother is in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. He has 4 years left, as his projected release date is 2018. Again, thank you, Danny, for having me on, and I'm glad to be on with your audience.
Well, you know, I happen to have visited a Supermax prison, actually did a story on the Marion Federal Correctional Institution in Illinois, which was the model of all these Supermaxes that then became state institutions as well as more federal institutions, really the model of Gitmo way back then. And this was a case of a prison which was really terribly run. There was an uprising there, and they just basically decided they would never reopen it as it was before and kept people in cells for 23 or 23 and a half hours, deprived them of any recourse, any rights whatsoever, and in many cases falsely classified people to be eligible for supermax conditions when in fact they were not people who had committed the crimes to do that kind of time. Give us a picture, if you will, of what the supermax situation is. What's it like to be in a supermax prison, Faisal? What does your brother deal with every day?
So a super maximum facility is 23 hours of solitary confinement with 1 hour of recreation inside of a cage with the people that are, I think, in your cell block area.
Pod.
So outside of that
23
hours, you don't have human contact unless it's with guards. And so 15 days of solitary confinement. Juan Mendez, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture, says it is torture. My brother has been in solitary confinement for six straight years, 3 years in New York at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, and this is going on his fourth year in the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado.
Tell us a little bit about his situation.
Sure. So for those that are unfamiliar with my brother's case, my brother's name is Fahad Hashmi. He grew up with alongside of us in Queens, New York. That's where we're from. We were raised here. My brother went to Stony Brook University, and then eventually he went to Brooklyn College, where he graduated in 2003 with a bachelor's in political science. I need to kind of give you a background of the case and what was leveled against him to kind of show the disparity in what the charges were to how he's being treated. So my brother went to Brooklyn College, graduated with a degree in political science, and then he moved to England in 2003 and pursued a master's in international relations. In early 2004, an individual by the name of Junaid Babar visited my brother and stayed with him for a period of 2 weeks and then left. In April of 2004, Junaid Babar gets arrested back in New York. My brother was still living in England at the time pursuing his degree, and Junaid Babar became a government witness, a cooperating witness in two or three cases around the world. There were about 10 people that got arrested in England, a person got arrested in Canada, maybe some folks in Pakistan as well, and they had charges leveled against them based on the testimony of Junaid Babar. So this was it was called the fertilizer case in England. He was the main witness against the defendants there. And this is in 2004. My brother never got arrested in 2004. He was not indicted as part of any plot that Junaid Babar said he was partaking in. Fast forward 2 years, as these other cases progress, and my brother's finishing his master's in international relations, on June 6, 2006, my brother gets arrested at the airport, at Heathrow Airport. he gets arrested on indictment from America. And it was really disclosed to us what the indictment was or what the actual nature of the charges were that were against him.
So stop right there for a quick second. This is one of the common issues where people can be held on the basis of undisclosed charges against them. And often for long periods of time before they're charged with anything. True?
This is true. In specifically my brother's case, he was, because he was in England at the time, he had an extradition hearing, or he was fighting extradition, which he did so for a year. He was held as a prisoner in Belmarsh Prison, which is their high-security prison. You know, the IRA folks were in Belmarsh and everything like that. So he was held in Belmarsh, you know, in a general population where he could interact with folks. He lost his extradition case. But from what we could tell, the charges against him basically amounted to a four-count indictment, two counts of conspiracy to provide material support and two counts of actual material support. And what the government claimed was that Junaid Babur stayed with him in 2004, and Junaid Babur had socks, ponchos, and raincoats in his luggage that Junaid Babur gave to the third in command of Al-Qaeda to run the insurgency in Pakistan after he left my brother. Not that my brother had these items, but this person had these items, and since he stayed with you, you facilitated material support. And there were four counts that amounted to 70 years in jail. This was the indictment against him. Not that my brother did all these things, but that this person, this cooperating witness,
So in other words, let's try to understand this. They nab him, okay, and he has quote material supplies on him. They track him or trace him to in a relationship in Pakistan, and they look back and see who is this person now, and they are about to charge him, and they give him a deal. Is that what you're telling us?
They nabbed him in 2004, and they got him in other plots that he was part of, or they alleged that he was part of in England, in Canada, but nothing to do with socks and ponchos. That was a separate thing altogether. They waited 2 years after, you know, those other plots or those other cases that he was part of to indict my brother on material support, saying, well, by the way, I stayed with Fahad Hashmi, and in my luggage I had these things, and after I left Fahad Hashmi's house, you know, I gave it to the third in command of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan.
Well, you know that when people hear the words Al-Qaeda, okay, a certain shudder comes down. And they don't really care what is done because of what, you know, they think has been done to us, which may or may not have been done to us with the 9/11. There's no sympathy for Al-Qaeda, certainly not in New York, certainly not in the United States. And so, in fact, for many, many years, Al Jazeera, which had nothing to do with Al-Qaeda, because the first letters of the station was Al, you know, it was assumed that they were somehow kissing cousins, okay? And it took them 10 years maybe to get on the air in the United States because of these insinuations and what have you. But the point is, your brother then pleads what? Guilty, not guilty?
So what happens is my brother gets extradited over, and he gets a team of lawyers on his side. For 3 years, he was held in solitary confinement awaiting his trial in under special administrative measures in the special housing unit in New York. As we find
stop,
out more,
stop again, stop, stop, stop. Special administrative measures. Now, that's a very Orwellian-sounding charge. What does that mean, special administrative measures?
So I think as your audience is familiar with Lynn Stewart's case, special administrative measures are restrictive measures imposed on a prisoner to stop their communication to the outside world, outside a select group of people, maybe their lawyers, their family, and their lawyers and their family are not allowed to communicate out to the outside world anything they said or, you know, their beliefs or anything of the sort. This was what Lynn Stewart was charged with breaking, the special administrative measures imposed on Sheikh Omar Abdulrahman. This is what Lynn Stewart went to jail for, and which he was released for yesterday.
Let me get this straight. Your brother is in a maximum security prison for having housed this guy for a week.
That's correct.
That is the crime.
That is a crime.
And he's okay.
He was facing 70 years in jail. He had been in up to the run up to his trial, which was 4 years, to when his trial was about to start. He was kept in isolation in one of the worst conditions, which is the MCC New York. His family was denied visits to him. So, you know, in the year before his trial, we visited him 3-5 times at most because we were turned away at the door. He wasn't allowed to communicate to the outside world, and he was just kept in, you know, harsh conditions at the MCC.
All right, so let me just jump back to a little thing you mentioned before Polar asked you that last question. Lynn Stewart. We've talked with Lynn Stewart's husband on the air here. We're familiar with her case. She was finally released from prison just yesterday. I had hoped to have her on, but I don't think she's doing any media. In fact, she seems to be in a very advanced state of terminal disease and apparently has been released to die. You know, and she, of course, protested her innocence and was turned down by the courts, was basically treated as if she herself was a terrorist. True?
Yeah, she was treated harshly, and her violations were administrative violations that were imposed. From what I understand about her case, she got indicted 2 years after the fact under the Ashcroft regime. After she supposedly broke the special administrative measures and this was pre 9/11. They waited till, you know, a couple of years after 9/11 to say that, well, she broke the SAMs and we can indict her.
So 9/11 again was used as this cudgel, this instrument of fear, associating her with 9/11, even though she wasn't really associated with 9/11. True?
That's correct. Yeah.
So here we have this situation, and you're working on something called the Muslim Justice, a Muslim Justice Initiative. Tell us what that is. Why do you think this is being done for religious reasons, or just because this person is suspected of terrorist crimes?
What we have learned is that there is a treatment of the Muslim defendant, or, you know, the problem is Muslims getting indicted in the first place for charges like this. You know, the U.S. attorney has great power to indict, you know, any citizen, and they've made examples out of the Muslim community. There are countless cases of entrapment that have littered the courtrooms across the United States. Countless cases of spinning or exaggerating what a person did. And what we have found in the past 12 years, or going on 13 years now, is that Muslims in America are besieged by the federal government. They're being portrayed as a threat, and their mosques, their businesses, their families are being infiltrated. Their friends, their Muslim students' associations are being infiltrated. And when they do face the justice system, they face a very harsh and draconian justice system where all the rules go out the window. From, you know, their pretrial conditions are torture. Their lawyers have to go through CIA clearance to defend them. What we're left with is a state where the Muslims in America are besieged from all sides, from the federal or state level, and being treated as the enemy. We are the new Red Scare.
You know, it's interesting that you bring all this up, because I'm thinking back, flashing back, if you will, in my own life, to a Muslim who I knew who had been imprisoned in America, who wrote about that imprisonment and became quite well known. I'm talking about Malcolm X, who was in prison in Norfolk prison in Massachusetts, where I lived for many years. And Malcolm wrote about his imprisonment. And, of course, many people became Muslims in prison because of their treatment there, or because of the support they were given by the Muslim community, imams and the like. So, you know, this is not a new story, but it's a particularly perverse story with the war on terror, war on error, whatever you want to call it, in high gear in the United States. And this case is a case in which the Center for Constitutional Rights has become involved. What is their case? What are you trying to do about this?
Well, so my brother has been in 6 straight years of solitary confinement. On the eve of his trial, he pled guilty to only one count, which was a 15-year sentence. He's been in solitary confinement for 6 straight years.
What is that count?
I'm sorry?
What is that count that he pleaded guilty
to? Conspiracy to provide material support, which is the allowing of Junaid Babur or this person to stay with him and have socks in their luggage. They threw out the other 3 charges, which were, you know, 55 years, thrown out the window, and they pled, or my brother pled, to a deal where they just leveled one charge against him.
Why should people care about this? Why should the average working American who works 12 hours a day and comes home, I mean, why is this important to him? Maybe you can fill us in on that.
Well, it starts with the infringement on the civil liberties and civil rights of one community, but then it starts extending to animal rights activists, environmentalists, anybody. In my brother's case, his conditions of confinement were torture, pre-trial, under the presumption of innocence. His lawyers, people seeking to defend him, had to go through CIA clearance. And his freedom of speech, my brother was a political activist while he was in New York, were the things that they said, you know, that they were going to use against him, his beliefs on American foreign policy. So the average American or Joe Schmo sitting at home, it's the same thing as a Snowden effect, where people have to understand, they have to safeguard their freedom of speech, their right to privacy, these type of things, because once it starts with one community, one person, the federal government or the government apparatus will not stop with just that community. It keeps extending outward and outward. They test their limits until you have a society that's, you know, completely Orwellian, and we are left with only government-sanctioned beliefs and values. But for, you know...
Would you say that our media is doing a good job of informing Americans about these cases? It's a legitimate... Harris raised the question, why should Americans care? But one of the reasons maybe they don't care is that they don't know about what's happening because it's not reported. That's what I think we can do here on the Progressive Radio Network is let people come on and talk about some of these issues that are not talked about widely in the press. Is that... do you agree with me on that?
You know, I appreciate the progressive channels like the Progressive Radio Network or Democracy Now. Those have been traditionally the outlets that understand the strife of the African American community, the Native American community, and now the Muslim community in America. These are all communities that have been besieged for a while now, and the mainstream media, fails to do so, or more than fails to do so, works against these communities and props up the government line about these communities. They prop up a particular narrative about how dangerous a particular community is, and allows for the sanctioning of their rights to be stripped away, of these communities' rights to be stripped away.
Faisal, I just want to get this out before we're running out of time on this segment, but I wanted to, you're going to be appearing in New York next week with a group of lawyers and people from the Center for Constitutional Rights. Can you tell us about that so that if anyone is listening wants to hear more here in the New York area, particularly they can come to this event?
Absolutely. So next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. at Judson Memorial Church, we're launching a group of us, of lawyers, the Center for Constitutional Rights, that has the backing of Amnesty International, a campaign called No Separate Justice, where we'll have a few folks like Liliana Segura, formerly of The Nation, now part of the new Glenn Greenwald, Pierre Omidyar media venture. We're going to have Pardis Kabarai of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and some family members of people in similar cases, that if you hear about these cases, you will, come to realize in shock and horror at what's going on.
So where
myself.
Is this event again? Just let's
the
tell
Judson
people.
Memorial Church in downtown New York.
In Greenwich Judson Village. And, I almost hesitated because I have an event coming on that night also at the Cornelia Street Cafe, but it's at 6. So if people wanted to come hear me talk about my Mandela book at 6 at the Cornelia Street Cafe, 29 Cornelia Street on the 7th, they could also head over to the Judson Memorial Church and hear you and the other people who will be there with you trying to take this issue, which has been sort of buried, and make it more public. And I think we have a lot of respect for people who are willing to speak out about it. I say this, largely because I investigated personally one of these Supermax prisons, and I spent time there. I directed a piece, segment for 2020 about it, which the Bureau of Prisons hated because we exposed all sorts of inconsistencies in their criteria and violations of the United Nations protocol in the treatment of prisoners as well on that 2020 piece. I'm proud of that. At least we put that issue on the horizon. But, of course, after 9/11 with Guantanamo, et cetera, and so forth, this has become a much more massive problem. It's interesting to know that some of the people are being released from Gitmo, and it may be eventually closed sooner rather than later, which is a good thing. So we would say to you, thank you for coming on. We want to thank and wish well Lynn Stewart, who's been on the program with Ralph Pointer, as she, you know, basically faces her toughest challenge to survive stage 4 cancer. Thank you very much for being with us on the program. When we come back, we're going to talk about maybe a serious subject, which is the legalization of marijuana in Colorado. Harris, our big boss here from the PRN network, is fuming, is outraged by the fact that marijuana is legal, but prostitution isn't. We'll hear more from him on that also in a minute or two here on PRN FM News Dissector Radio.
Here in jail, it is so nice. A month of dirt, anybody like. Hard times in a wild kind of jail, as hard times I know. Wise kind of jail, no jail at all. Changes and bugs are walking the wall. Hard times in a wild kind of jail, as hard times I know.
ABC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News, breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN. To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Yeah, that's the elegantly disheveled Polarity One who put that collage together called Media Wars. And I happen to know through sources that he was high on marijuana in the studio when he put Media Wars together. And we just happened by coincidence to have Betty Aldworth with us, who is the deputy director of the National Cannabis Association, to talk about what is happening in Colorado. You with us, Betty?
Please be with us, Betty. Thanks so much for having me this afternoon.
Well, Betty, it's the big day, right? Marijuana, cannabis, legal in Colorado. That's a big breakthrough. A lot of people worked a long time to make that happen. What's it feel like?
You know, cannabis has been legal to use and possess by adults in Colorado for more than a year since the governor certified the ballot for Amendment 64. What happened yesterday is that we opened our very first retail establishments. And we were able to start the process of moving marijuana off the streets and behind a counter yesterday. We had probably about $1 million in sales here in Colorado, lines stretched around the block of people who were hoping to participate in making history yesterday at the about 35 stores that were open here in the state.
So what does it cost, since you are monetizing all of this, what does it cost and what's the quantities that marijuana is available in Colorado?
You can purchase marijuana in grams or portions of ounces. If someone is visiting Colorado from another state, they're able to purchase up to a quarter ounce. And if they are a Colorado resident, they can purchase up to an ounce on any given day. It seems like yesterday most of the adults who were shopping in Colorado were purchasing 8 ounces for about $50.
Well, $50 for an eighth of an ounce. How does that compare with the street price in New York, Harris? You would know.
I don't know the street price in New York. But here's what I want to ask you, Betty. I mean, what is it like? I mean, bring us through the process. You want to buy some pot? What are these stores like? What do they look like from the outside? Take us through the whole purchasing process. Where would we go in
like
Denver?
7-Elevens or
Dairy Queen?
No. These are stores that specifically and only sell marijuana, either for adult use exclusively, or the marijuana that's grown in the adult use system, or marijuana that's grown in the medical use system, or some combination of
the two.
Does
it say pot outside? Does it have a sign that says pot?
You know, the name of the business is on the business itself. There are a lot of rules around advertising and how you can present your business on the signage, especially here in Denver. But it's clear from the outside that these are stores that are selling marijuana. So as soon as you walk in, you have to show your ID. You get in line and you step to a counter where, you know, sanitary, tested and high quality cannabis is available, just like when you walk into the door of a liquor store.
You have to show ID, what, to show that you're a certain age?
To show that you're at least 21 years old.
Nationality,
yeah.
Okay.
So what's been the reaction there to this? I mean, if one can say, what's the reaction? I mean, media reaction, political reaction, people have obviously voted for this and accepted it. Is there a diehard group there that is against it?
You know, overall, the reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. People tend to understand that, you know, marijuana sales exist anyway. Thousands and thousands of people across the U.S. purchased marijuana yesterday, as my friend Mason DeVert likes to say, and only in Colorado were those sales legal for social use. So, you know, there are a lot of folks in our elected officials and most folks in the media and many people in the kind of like the business structure and communities of Colorado understand that it's of benefit to sell marijuana from a retail establishment. We can create legitimate jobs, generate tax revenue, and take the power of marijuana away from cartels and criminals. There are absolutely those people who are arguing that this is going to be a negative for Colorado. I think that yesterday demonstrated that that's just patently untrue.
Are you concerned at all about the slippery slope, the possibility that people will be getting high on marijuana while committing acts of bestiality? I mean,
that's a first.
You must have thought of this.
I'm not concerned about that at all.
Okay. That's a reasonable answer.
It's not the craziest thing that I've heard someone say.
I bet. But claims about what marijuana
might make someone do.
But we know that
all of those drug war claims are false.
But you use the J initial there, jobs. You know, this could create not only jobs in Colorado, but should Colorado be the pioneer for the whole country, this could create and legalize a whole industry which will really generate a lot of revenue, tax revenue and the like, and hopefully that would help support education and other social needs. Yes, true.
That's the plan. You know, all you have to do is look at the medical marijuana system in any of these states where we have state-regulated medical marijuana or that where it's going to be coming online in 2014, and you can see that the job creation potential is tremendous. And here's the great thing about these jobs. They can't be shipped overseas. They're living wage jobs. It's, you know, there's great opportunity to start at the bottom and move your way up very quickly for the most competent of employees, and there are a lot of folks who are building strong, vibrant, legitimate careers in the marijuana industry in Colorado.
And there's a pretty high sales tax rate on it, right?
Did you say high?
Yes, I did.
Okay, everybody is joking about this.
The tax rate is an important element, right?
The state song in Colorado has been Rocky Mountain High. Anyway,
there you go.
Betty, I mean, why Colorado? How did Colorado pull this off when in so many other communities it's been a divisive issue to some degree, certainly one that's been put down by media mavens and politicians and the like?
You know, in Colorado, we've been having a conversation since 2004 about the place of marijuana in our society for adult social use. And we've been talking for a long time about the objective fact that that marijuana is safer than alcohol. We've been talking about, you know, the fact that it doesn't make sense to, you know, punish people for using marijuana in very similar ways to how they use alcohol. And since we've been having this conversation for such a very long time, I think Colorado was ready to have a conversation about whether or not people should be able to purchase marijuana in a store. And so when we initiated that conversation last year for the campaign itself, we really had a population that was ready to think about marijuana differently than a lot of other people are willing to think about it.
I mean, New Hampshire
we
has
also had the example of a oh, go ahead.
No, New Hampshire has had state-run liquor stores. Is this privately owned, state-owned? Is it a cooperative? How does it actually organize the actual retail operations?
In Colorado, they are privately owned operations, and the folks who are selling the marijuana in retail stores also have to cultivate it themselves. So it's the same business doing the cultivation and the retail sales. We also have a couple hundred infused product manufacturers. So those people making the lotions, the lozenges, the tinctures and other products that you, for which you can use marijuana without having to smoke it.
I love the way you say tinctures, Betty. That's really a great word. Harris, you were going to ask a major question.
How much does pot cost in Colorado?
We asked that.
Right.
$50 for an eighth of an ounce. Here, I think it's 60. I think that's right.
But, you know, there are costs involved in growing marijuana. Is a lot of it grown indoors, for example?
You know, indoor marijuana cultivation has been the norm in Colorado up to this point. But we do have a handful of outdoor cultivators who grow sun-grown. And what we're seeing more and more is that, you know, as we're legitimizing this business, as we're regulating it, and as we're building rules around how these businesses can operate, they are looking at things like energy consumption. And so we're seeing many more greenhouses being built in response to Amendment 64 in order to meet that demand. And I think that we'll see a shift away from warehouses and towards greenhouses as we move forward.
And how are purchases being taxed?
So the tax rate, you're right, is quite high. It's 15% excise tax on the wholesale transfer of marijuana from the cultivation facility to the retail store. And then there is a 10% sales tax here in Colorado, in addition to the regular state sales tax and the local sales tax.
A 10% tax on the marijuana.
Like it's, Denver.
There's a 10%.
Right, right.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's a point of interest for me, because I know in Prohibition back in the 20s, the taxation.
Yes, of course I was.
The taxation of it was very important, because liquor provided a gigantic proportion of tax revenues, and when Prohibition went into effect, that was one of the big consequences, a big bite out of the national treasury.
To get back to what we were talking about before. It's only $2. I mean, you can't buy a value meal at McDonald's for $2. You can't get a drink. I mean, what can you do with a few dollars? And apparently this may be one of the great bargains in Colorado.
Well, you can get value meals.
Oh, no. So I think that what you're referring to is, in Uruguay, they are going to start some government-run stores where they're projecting the cost of marijuana to be about $2.50 per gram.
Per gram.
Here, the cost is closer to about $15 or $17 per gram. That being said, the savings that we're going to be able to start realizing with economies of scale, with bringing cultivation, cultivating in larger facilities, we'll be able to drive the costs, the the cost to cultivate down, and we'll eventually see those benefits reflected in the price.
Would you say that, you know, the fact that you actually managed to have a rational discourse about marijuana, that the voters actually adopted, you know, voted for it, basically, that the press seems to have accepted it, is a sort of signal of something that's unique to Colorado, but maybe not to the rest of the country, where there's so much demagoguery when it comes to any social change issues?
You know, I think that what has happened in based on the conversations that we've been having in Colorado and Washington, I mean, clearly the world is watching, right? We had media here from all over the world, all over the country yesterday, and people want to know how we're doing what we're doing and how it's going to turn out. And so there's a national conversation happening right now about marijuana's role in our society. And, you know, should it be a drag on our local economies by, you know, forcing people into the criminal justice system and, you know, empowering cartels and us not being able to capture any of the tax revenue and job creation? Or should we turn it into a benefit for our communities?
I mean, you have had...
That conversation is happening far beyond Colorado.
I mean, I don't know what the latest figures were, but, you know, we had 2 million marijuana-related arrests in years past. And this was a great... you know, kind of issue for police departments and courts and all the rest of it. You know, the criminalization of marijuana was definitely in the interests of the legal system in some respects. Now, with this change, will there also be a change, for example, in the way other issues are discussed, or in the way marijuana is discussed in schools, for example?
Well, I think that what we've demonstrated is that when you're honest with people about marijuana and its real impacts, you aren't losing, you're winning. You even see in the way that the drug warriors talk about marijuana has shifted dramatically, the way that the DARE program talks about marijuana has shifted dramatically, and they have figured out, finally, mostly, that you can't lie to young people about the effects of marijuana, because they're going to figure out that young people are pretty smart. They're going to figure out that you're lying.
Do you think the days of reefer madness are over?
Well, you know, we have a lot of work to do. There's no question that, you know, there are many places that could be benefiting from the regulation of marijuana instead of prohibition, which has completely failed. But I think that yesterday was another one of those points that we'll look to as the beginning of the end.
Is big business going to get involved in marijuana as we go down the road here?
Well, listen, there's no question that pharmaceutical companies are looking at marijuana and its medical benefits, that there are, you know, just like we have microbrewers and large breweries and everybody in between, eventually we're probably going to have something somewhat similar in the marijuana market. But the fact of the matter is, nobody is going to be looking at this until it's federally legal, unless they have a very high risk tolerance.
I'm sure the tobacco companies are thinking about it right now.
So what is the potential conflict with the federal government, or the real conflict that's going on? I mean, you can't go to Colorado, buy some marijuana, and fly to another place necessarily, right? I mean, aren't there still prohibition in much of the rest of the country?
Yes. In fact, you can't buy marijuana in Colorado and fly to anywhere, even Washington State, where it's also legal. If you purchase marijuana in Colorado, you have to keep it in Colorado, because the laws of the state that you are in are the laws that apply. So we're undergoing a significant consumer education effort in Colorado and in Washington to make sure that people understand that. But the larger federal-state conflict here is that, you know, we're still breaking federal law. Now, the Department of Justice has acknowledged that, given the fact that people are sick of putting other people in prison over marijuana, that a regulated market is going to do a better job of controlling it than the underground economies and the underground markets. You know, a regulated business, it has a financial interest in making sure they're not selling marijuana to anyone under 21. A regulated business has a financial interest to make sure that the marijuana they're selling is high quality, clean, and sanitary. So, you know, there are many benefits that come along with a regulated market. And there's a great deal of oversight, auditing, and control that, you know, that we have to, the businesses here have to, acquiesce to the state. So there's, so while the federal government has acknowledged that regulated markets are probably better, that doesn't mean we're not breaking federal law every day. We are.
Didn't the federal government,
there's a lot more work to do.
Weren't there raids on medical marijuana clinics in Los Angeles and other parts of California directed by, you know, coming out of Washington and the federal drug police agencies?
Generally, those sorts of actions are left to the discretion of individual U.S. attorneys, but there was a directive from the Department of Justice just a few months ago saying that they are firmly directing their U.S. attorneys to allow these state markets to develop, these state-regulated systems to develop, and that as long as there are 8 different federal enforcement priorities that they've identified, and as long as we aren't breaking any of those rules, they're going to let this experiment happen for some period of time.
Betty,
now, they said that with the caveat that they can come back and change their minds about it. So that's always a risk.
Betty, what does this mean to people like you who work for the Cannabis Association on a personal level? I mean, in another organization, you might pop the champagne corks. But I would suppose when this law became in effect today, it was very different. Bring us home on a personal level. What does it mean?
You know, for me, it was so exciting to be able to visit. I went and visited 6 different stores yesterday. Didn't make a purchase at any of them because the lines were so long. But at each of those stores, people were so happy to be able to participate in making history. The folks standing in line yesterday, they could have gone to any number of places in Denver and purchased marijuana on the underground market, but they chose to stand in line for sometimes as long as 3 hours to be able to participate in this. And this is the first moment where we get to, you know, really take marijuana off the street, put it behind a counter, and start to demonstrate to the rest of the world that marijuana prohibition has failed and regulation is better. I could not be any more pleased.
You know,
we were having yesterday in Colorado.
We were having, Betty, a heated discussion, almost came to the fisticuffs here in the studio about whether or not to smoke marijuana in solidarity with the people of Colorado to show that you're not alone in your desire for a rational market. Do you envision, you know, any sort of national effort to try to basically live like Colorado on the part of ordinary Americans to recognize that if it can happen there, it can happen anywhere?
Well, you know, when it comes to people consuming marijuana themselves personally, prohibition really hasn't stopped anyone from doing that. If people want to use marijuana, they generally will, right? And use rates across the country demonstrate that. But what we are seeing is a lot of effort on the state level to start making the same kind of change in other states that we've made here in Colorado and in Washington. The Marijuana Policy Project, our friends over there are working on legalization initiatives in Alaska and perhaps several other states for 2014. And in 2016, we're going to see many more states.
I wonder if there's going to be
asking.
I didn't mean to cut you off here. We're running out of time, but I wanted to get this in. I wonder if there's going to be any pressure here in New York City now that our new mayor, known as Blas by the Daily News, the D-Train, Mr. de Blasio, has taken office and promised a progressive agenda. I don't think he's mentioned marijuana legalization yet, but it's possible as he attempts to end the two cities of New York, the city of the 1%, the city of the 99%, as he speaks out for justice in New York, which is nice to see somebody in a major position speaking out on. You know, he speaks of New York as a city of five boroughs, all created equal, black, white, Latino, Asian, gay, straight, old, young, rich, middle class, and poor. A city that remembers our responsibility to each other is to leave no New Yorker behind. This is the city that you and I believe in, he said. But where does marijuana enter into this?
Do you think we need marijuana? I mean, maybe with all the ills we have in our country and all the fighting and all the disagreements, maybe we need pot. Maybe it might be good for us as a people.
Well,
what do you think, Betty?
Well, you know, to answer the first question, everything that Mayor de Blasio says about creating a new New York and a progressive New York lead to the arguments for regulating marijuana. And if I remember correctly, he's come out strongly against the practice of stop and frisk, which was a disastrous policy almost exclusively for young black men
and also
men of color in New York.
Also disastrous for decades has been the notorious Rockefeller drug laws that every politician come every election talks about cutting back, and then they never really do.
Yeah, and of course the arrests,
yeah, absolutely.
The arrests of young people on pot charges, smoking in the park or smoking in the streets, you know, has given a lot of young people criminal records, and has not, as far as I can tell, solved any problems for our city. But Betty, we just want to thank you so much for coming on the air and explaining to a bunch of old guys here in New York City how Colorado pulled this off. It's a very significant story, and you know, to be honest with you, we weren't planning to discuss this on the program, but I read a story about the first man that purchased marijuana in Colorado, of Iraq veteran, and I wanted to reach him, and we reached you instead, and we're so happy that you joined us and explained all this to us, because this is really important stuff, and people have heard it first here on News Dissector Radio on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN-FN. There will be a podcast of this show available online in the PRN archives, also in my blog at newsdissector.net. You can check that out. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. We hope to be back next week, and maybe in more in future weeks, to talk about these issues on the air here on PRN-FM. Thank you so much for joining us.
Come on. Side are you on, boy? Which side are you?